It was completely exhilarating. And as an American, somebody who grew up in the United States and an American citizen, and seeing so many of the values that we cherish here at home in the U.S., the values of democracy, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of expression, to see them being fought for on the streets of Egypt was one of a great sense of pride for me, to see that Egyptians who for years had been criticized for being apathetic or distant or not engaged in their country, now taking to the streets to demand their own rights, their own freedoms, was something that was extremely, extremely emotional for me. And it was something that over the years I had grown to appreciate in the United States, and for the first time was witnessing on the streets of Cairo. So I think it was to say that out of all the stories I've covered in my life, I've probably never gone through a range of emotions, from fear to happiness to joy to just concern and being afraid for my own life and my own safety like I was during the course of those 18 days.
Give us the big picture. What is going on here? How could you go along? How could these countries go along for so long with dictatorial rule, and all of a sudden it's like the whole area explodes into, we want to be democracy, we don't want to be ruled this way by a tyrant anymore?
Well, the way I look at it in very simple terms is that the fear factor had been broken. And what I mean by that is that you're absolutely right. We have known these problems for decades. The symptoms have always been there. Poverty, the lack of rule of law, the lack of democracy, lack of accountability, oppression. We knew that they were there. So it was all about what was going to be the catalyst that was going to ignite this kind of anger in these people to demand this awakening. And the way I look at it is that it was really the power of information. Information played such an important role in serving as a catalyst for ordinary Tunisians and Egyptians and Arabs all across the Arab world to know what their rights were and to demand them. And I think that's really why I subscribe to the notion that these are the first revolutions of the information age. Information, whether it was the internet, satellite channels, cell phones, really empowered ordinary Arabs to break their fear factor. And once their fear factor had been broken, there was no going back. And that's why we will continue to see it spread across the Arab world.
As it is now, we've got protests going on in Yemen. Of course, the situation in Libya, it's much different than Egypt. I would love your thoughts on what's happening there.
Well, Libya is a very unique case, but it began with the same principles that the Tunisian and Egyptian revolutions began with, which is a demand and a desire by the people of Libya for a better future, in the sense that they began as peaceful protests, and then when the government realized that it had a revolt on its hand, it used force to suppress it and turned this conflict into a violent conflict. But it began as a struggle for values of freedom and democracy and rule of law. We know that. That's what the expressed demands of the protesters had been from day one. The situation now has unfortunately turned very violent because of the regime and the violence that they're willing to use to maintain power. And so we've seen the institutions of the Libyan state, particularly the military, essentially crumble. And as a result of that, so too have the functions of the state. And as a result, the state splintering into the East and the West, where the East now controls most of, where the rebels control most of the East, and the city of Tripoli really under the control of the Gaddafi regime. But in reality, it's still very much a struggle for values. It is not a civil war between sides competing for interests or access to oil or power. It is not. It is a battle of ideology between a regime that represents the past, it represents oppression, it represents a lack of development, and those who no longer want it to stand under that type of regime. And therefore, what you're seeing are these rebels who are trying to gather international support, gather momentum domestically among various affiliations, including tribes and others, to try and bring down this regime by any means necessary.
Ayman, you are with Al Jazeera English, based in Cairo. How do you respond to people in America? You say Al Jazeera, and a lot of people think pro-Arab, anti-Israeli. How do you deal with that? Are you trying to be a straight down the middle news service, or what do you tell folks?
I wouldn't describe it as we are trying to be. I say we are. I would say I would let every individual in this country make up that decision for themselves. Watch our newscasts, watch the output, watch the journalism, and judge for yourself. If you think that we are a credible news organization, then you should certainly lend your voice to bringing Al Jazeera to the United States. At the end of the day, we can't even have that discourse because the United States, particularly American citizens, are being deprived of the choice of watching Al Jazeera. We are journalists from all walks of life. We have with us Jewish journalists, we have Christian journalists, we have Muslim journalists, we have American journalists, we have journalists from more countries than I can possibly name. At the end of the day, we let the journalism speak for itself, and we ask our viewers to do the same. If there's any criticism, we are certainly welcome to entertain it, but more importantly, it's the caliber and quality of our work that should be the deciding factor for viewers. It shouldn't be propaganda. It shouldn't be scare tactics. It shouldn't be stereotypes.
And explain why we can't get Al Jazeera in this country, why it's not carried by cable outlets and satellite outlets.
Well, unfortunately, we're often told of two reasons. And if you personally ask me, you know, in a capitalistic country like this, they seem to be the most anti-capitalistic arguments I can imagine, which is that Americans at the end of the day are being deprived of the choice of watching Al Jazeera. But sometimes the answers fluctuate, which is apathy, and sometimes it's perception. And what I mean by that is we're sometimes told by these cable companies that, oh, Americans don't care about international news. They simply are oversaturated with news outlets like CNN and Fox and MSNBC. There's simply no appetite for more news on their cable systems. Well, when you put the numbers in front of them and you tell them, for example, that Al Jazeera's viewership has gone up 2,500% during the revolutions, that its website during the peak of the coverage surpassed that of the New York Times, with the vast majority of that viewership coming from North America, you show them those numbers and you say that is not true. Americans are not apathetic. They want international news and they now know where to get it online. You should provide it for them on their television sets. Well, then they tell you, oh, well, it's the perception. It's the perception that Al Jazeera is a biased network and all that. But then you put forth comments like that of Secretary Clinton, who came out and said, you know, that Al Jazeera is real news. And you show them the comments and the coverage, and then they find themselves really without any more answers. It's sad in this day and age in the United States that a handful of companies and corporations control the airwaves and control what Americans can see, and depriving them just seems to me inherently anti-capitalistic, anti-democratic. People should be given the choice and let the numbers and the viewers speak for themselves.
Eamon, President Obama has said on numerous occasions that the American government, the American people are not anti-Muslim, we're against terrorists. Do you believe that the Muslim world believes that, or is that message still not getting across?
I believe that the United States message is not resonating very loudly. I don't believe that all Muslims believe that particularly, that the United States is at war or that there's a clash with the Muslim world, so to speak. What I do feel and what I believe wholeheartedly from having been on the Arab street for the better part of the last 10 years in some of the most tense areas is that the United States foreign policy, as a result of so many military interventions in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in its perceived bias in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict towards Israel, what ends up happening is that the United States has lost a great deal of credibility. It has spent a lot of its currency to be seen as an objective broker in that part of the world. And therefore, when President Obama stands up and says that he or the United States is not at odds with the Muslim world, it does not resonate as loudly as it should. People are not convinced by it as loudly as it should. And the message really has to be delivered, not just in terms of rhetoric, it needs to be delivered in terms of policy.
Did Libya help or hurt?
Libya actually is a position where it can help. It has not hurt. It can help. That depends on the scope of the military operation, how big America's military footprint in Libya is going to be. What will America demand of the new government that emerges in the wake of the post-Qaddafi regime? And in doing so, I think we have a chance where, for the first time in a long time, there is a convergence of interests between what the United States' military is achieving on the ground and what the Arab street wants the United States to achieve. In this particular case, it genuinely is a true opportunity, but that all depends on whether or not the United States remains committed to the values it espouses and stands with these rebels from a value-driven perspective, not necessarily an interest-driven perspective.
Eamon, all these weeks after the Egyptian revolution, you're based there in Cairo. What's it like now?
It remains very tense. It remains somewhat unstable. What I can say positively is that there's a great sense of optimism that remains on the streets of Egypt. The relationship between the state and the citizens has changed for the first time in a long time, and that's very empowering. Ordinary Egyptians feel a sense of empowerment. They've gone out in record numbers to vote in the referendum for the amendment of the Constitution. That in itself was historic. I think the road is going to be long and bumpy, and Egyptians are not naive to that. They know that it's still going to be a long process to rebuild the institutions of the state and, more importantly, to purge the state from former elements of the regime. That's going to take time. That's not lost on anyone's mind. But there's no doubt that at the same time, the euphoria of the celebration of the revolution has begun to wear off. People are waking up to the post-party hangover, if you like, and with that comes a great deal of responsibility. A lot of tough questions have to be asked. Ordinary Egyptians have to ask a lot of tough questions about women's rights, about minority rights, about what they want from their state, and they have to take ownership. And you have to get people back out into the streets to believe that they have a lot at stake, not just to give up and go back to their homes and say, you know what, the ousting of Mubarak was the end. It's the exact opposite. It was just the beginning. So I think it's going to be a long road. It's going to take many years for Egypt to make that transition. But nonetheless, it is one that is happening in a very optimistic Egypt for the first time.